Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Today's episode is brought to you with the welcome support of Malbin Greek, UK's leading Greek delicatessen, supplier and distributor of premium Greek produce. Whatever your needs, Malbin Greek has you covered. You can shop online and have the divine and delicious goods delivered to your doorstep across the UK, or you can visit the shop at Arch 17 Apollo Business Park, Lucy Way, SC16, 4ET, Bermondsey, London. Malbin Greek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. Hello, this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Welcome back to another archaeogastronomical adventure. With me, Thomas Dinas. Now, what would Tibetan deer, the baleen whale, and the pomegranate have in common? What the heck is that connects these things? And certainly, what is it that makes them so interesting that I dedicate a whole episode about them? And what's the connection with the spices and spice trade? And of course, food. Well, if you have a little patience, sit here with me and enjoy this episode. So I would like to take the opportunity to ask you some question about the podcast here. Do you prefer the episodes to be released on a Monday or on a Wednesday? When is it more likely that you will listen to them? And on a similar note, if you noticed, I'm trying to produce one episode a week. Is that something that, is it good or is it too much for you guys? Or do you prefer that I go back to one episode bi-weekly, like 2 episodes a month or so? Please let me know what your preferences are. I'd be interested to know. And you can tweet me on Twitter at Delicious Legacy. You can also email me at the Delicious Legacy Podcast, all one word, at gmail.com. And of course, you can reach me out on Instagram, which I'm as the Delicious Legacy as well. So yeah, get in touch and let me know what's more convenient for you guys. Now, we certainly have encountered musk and the derivatives of it in a perfumery and also, you know, the glands of animals and so on. But what is the connection here with spices and our food? This seems very odd way of starting an episode. Musk is one of the most enduring aromatic and potent aromatic in the world and comes from a very rare substance held in the glands, in the scent glands of some of the most endangered deer living in Asia, in the genus of Moschus. Now, to attract mates and to repel competing rivals, they have a unique way of doing this. They mark their territory by dropping grain-like secretions onto shrubs and at its margins from an abdominal pouch that protrudes not far from the genitals. So in the wild, a mature buck will produce and paste 20 to 25 grams of this waxy, blood colored musk grains into shrubs on each mating season. When these pasty droppings are dried, they become charcoal black. Charcoal black grains, rich in the pheromone known as muscone to chemists. And the fragrance of freshly harvested musk is so powerful, so potent, that newcomers find it either completely repulsive or, for some reason, divinely pleasurable. This, of course, has to be diluted, and musk, once it's diluted, has a warm, aromatic, earthy fragrance that some have likened it to scent of freshly cut wood or a baby skin just after bath. That's not my description, but what some people describe as a sweet smell, something like, I don't know how to describe it otherwise, but I know it sounds a bit weird as a description of a smell, but it kind of also makes sense, you know, if you ever been near babies, I suppose. There are some tantalizing evidence that musk could possibly have been traded very locally, as early as frankincense, so around 3500 BCE. But thousands of years passed, and by the 6th century CE, musk had become the most widely sought after and highly prized fragrance in the world, with a single kilo of musk worth twice the value of an equal amount of gold. For comparison, today musk worth still quite a lot, and it's like 3 or 4 times its weight in gold. Beyond being used in perfumes and aromatics and incenses, it had many uses, like aromatic soaps, for example. And in India, it was valued as a cardiac cure for diseases. And in Europe and Great Britain, it found culinary favor as an ingredient in baked goods, beverages, candies, ice creams, molasses, and puddings. The name seems to originate from the late Greek moschos, from the Persian word musk and Sanskrit muska, which probably means something like testicle. And of course, natural musk pods occur in Chinese traditional medicine. And when Marco Polo described the collection of amber musk grains off the forest floor for trade westward, they were probably being gathered in the natural habitat of the Siberian musk deer in either the Tian Shan or the Altai Mountains. Once these were widespread musk deer species ranged from Siberia and Outer Mongolia southwestward across the trade routes and all the way to Kazakhstan. Mongolian and Uyghur harvesters knew how to obtain the grains without killing the deer, and no doubt passed them on the Sogdian traders, who, starting in the 5th century CE, of course, annually delivered as much as 1,500 kilograms of musk westwards, as far as Constantinople, Athens, and Rome. It takes about killing 30 to 50 sexually mature bucks to gather the 1 kilogram of musk. So you can imagine that at some point the demand was really high for good quality musk, amber musk. So that put pressure to nomadic traders and nomadic hunters to kill and gut the animals rather than sustainably harvest the musk. By the 19th century, the range of the Siberian musk deer had contracted and the number of deer had declined dramatically. And today, the only surviving population in China remains in the most remote reaches of the Altai Mountains. Once the traditional primary sources for amber musk declined, harvesters turned to Tonkin musk from the black musk deer living in the Tibetan highlands. In time, its fragrance became even more highly regarded than that of the amber musk, but the black musk deer population soon rapidly declined as well. And of course, finally, poachers, hoping to meet the continuing demand, ruthlessly began hunting a third species from farther south in the Himalayas, and its numbers have also fallen. Now, all three species are considered vulnerable to extinction, and the sales of their products are banned, thankfully, through international treaties of wildlife trade. There's a Persian Arab dessert called Falut Haj, a confection made from sugar, starch and nuts and flavored with musk and rose water. The Balina penetrates to our seas even, Pliny wrote. It is said that they are not to be seen in the ocean of Gades before the winter solstice, and that at periodical seasons they retire and conceal themselves in some calm, capacious bay, in which they take a delight in bringing forth. This fact, however, is known to the orca, an animal which is peculiarly hostile to the balina, and the form of which cannot be in any way adequately described, but as an enormous mass of flesh armed with teeth. This animal attacks the balinian in its places of retirement, and with its teeth tears its young, or else attacks the females which have just brought forth, and indeed while they are still pregnant. And this is from Natural History of Pliny, which in a passage talking about the whales, which is remarkably accurate in the behavior of the whales and the orcas, indeed. Mixed with wine, it was considered an aphrodisiac. It was used to ward off the plague and as medicine to treat headaches, colds, epilepsy, and other illnesses. Louis XV of France is said to have spiced his favorite dishes with it, and Elizabeth I was said to have used it as a spice. But what is that mysterious substance, this sought-after fragrance, that was used as a spice? And also, it was used in medicine and in perfumery. This substance is called ambergris, and it begins his arduous, long, mysterious journey in the depths of the ocean, hundreds and hundreds of tons of seawater in the darkness and in the warm and cavernous gut of the sperm whale. A sperm whale is huge, obviously, just almost all whales that we know of. A male bull probably weighs about 50 tons. So a sperm whale must consume about a ton of food a day to stay alive. To do that, they dive in depths of several hundred meters and beyond the farthest reaches of sunlight, where they ingest hundreds of pounds of deep water squid. Ambergris was already a sought-after fragrance and valuable commodity in ancient times. The Egyptians burned it as an incense, and in Arabian culture, the fragrance was just as well known as in the coastal regions of the Indian Ocean. English upper classes perfumed their gloves with it. In Egypt, it's still used, ambergris is still used, to flavor cigarettes. The first evidence of the use of ambergris in fine perfumery comes from the Arabs in Spain in the 10th century, and this was imported from the Sunda Islands and from Maghreb. At the beginning of the modern era, ambergris was traded through Europe and in many cases was weighted out with gold. Al-Hassan ibn Mohammed al-Wasan, called in Western Europe Johannes Leo Africanus, around 1490, wrote that the price of 1 pound of ambergris on the market in Fez was 60 ducats, which corresponds to that of 3 slaves. I know it's a very weird analogy, but those were the times. The finest and most valuable ambergris is pale grey to golden yellow, or in very rare cases, chalky white. It's a very strange substance, and it's one of these things, together with musk, that conjures extremely weird feelings in people, I suppose, the smell of it. For a long, long time, there was much uncertainty and ambiguity about the origin of ambergris. The Chinese called them Langxianhiang and imagined dragons sleeping on coastal rocks and drooling in the sea while they slept. The saliva, they believed, was the source of the fragrance. In Japanese culture, on the other hand, the spoke of Kunsurano Fu, the Arab traveler and historian Al-Masudi, reported of merchants and sailors who believed that ambergris grew like mushrooms on the seabed and was occasionally washed ashore by storms. Marco Polo was the first Western traveler, allegedly, to report that the sperm whale of ambergris was hunted by Yemeni sailors of the Socotra Islands. Culturally and etymologically, ambergris was confused probably with amber, the true amber, the yellow one, and to distinguish it between, obviously, ambergris, between amber and ambergris, the English word ambergris is used today for the excretory product of sperm whales, which is derived from the French ambergris and ultimately from the Arabic word anbar. So it's a very, this is a very complex and very balanced fragrance and has a series of notes and sample notes that combine and give a harmonious character to the smell, to the odor. It's typically very marine type of odor, and different people described it like perception of the open ocean and not along the coasts, that smell, accompanied by a violet tone occurring in algae, or perceptible scent of damp, moss-covered ground in a forest, but without the musty effect of it. A precious fragrance of exotic wood and an incense-like tonality, such as is found in ancient cathedrals. Fine smell of tobacco, and so on and so on. I can go on forever. That's all the description of the odor of ambergris. So ambergris is initially a waxy, soft mass in the intestine of the sperm whale. That's why we're talking about sperm whales here. And it forms after an injury by the horned jaws of the squid, which is the preferred food of the whale. So the ambergris serves as an antibiotic wound closure in which the indigestible components are all embedded of the squid. So the concretions enter the sea through vomiting as fecal stones or through the natural death of the animals. And it can weigh anything between a few grams and 100 kilograms. And it's almost black lumps. And initially that smells of feces, obviously, and floats on the surface of the sea due to its low density. And while it's floating, there happens this transformation, this photochemical degradation and oxidization, which transforms it to a very highly prized perfumery raw material. But as we will see, not only perfume. So like the other valuable animal perfume, musk or civet or castoreum, so ambergris fills a perfect, slots perfectly on that kind of niche of aromas. It was used obviously for ceremonial and religious purposes, but also started used by nobles for its fragrance and the mysterious effect of its odor. Christopher Kemp, a molecular biologist, writes in his book about ambergris that ambergris was melted like butter onto roasted game encased in pastries. It was also used in sweets and desserts and as an ingredient, as a fragrance. So Persian sherbets included ambergris along with water and lemon. And apparently Casanova added it to his chocolate mousse as an aphrodisiac. And the French gastronome Brillat Savarin recommended a shilling's worth of ambergris in a tonic of chocolate and sugar, which he claimed could render life more easy. Like coffee, but without the restless sleeplessness. Of course, being one of these mysterious substances that ancient people didn't know much about it, or where was it coming from, or being so rare, obviously was used a lot in perfume making and also in cooking, but not as common as we think, obviously. We haven't found any recipes from ancient Greece or ancient Rome that they use it. But we do have some evidence from medieval Arab and Indian cuisines, which basically adopted or copied elements from the court cuisine of the medieval Persia. And of course, the use of their aromatics in foods like orange blossoms, roses, other flowers, sandalwoods, camphor. And there is, of course, our ambergris in the food itself. There's an example of a 15th century recipe, the Nimatnama manuscript of the Sultans of Mandu. Boil the meat well, take it off the fire, dry it, and fasten it to a wooden skewer. Mix saffron, white ambergris, and rose water together and rub it on the meat. Put it in a cooking pot and add rice. Put in fresh ginger, onions, and salt and cook it. Serve it with good gravy. Since ambergris was part of medieval Arab cuisine, it might well have entered the cuisines of the medieval European privileged elites, which incorporated many Arab influences. But we haven't seen it yet in an English or French medieval recipe manuscript. Perhaps it can be seen or found at some point in medieval Italian recipe manuscripts, because Renaissance Italian court cooks used in biscotti and other sweets a lot of aromatics and flavorings such as musk and so on. I'll be back after this short break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello there, sorry to interrupt. My name's Dr. Neil Buttery and I'm host of the British Food History Podcast, a podcast that you, as a fan of the delicious legacy, might be interested in. I explore British food and its history in all its glory, with interviews with special guests, recipes, reenactments, and tracking down forgotten recipes and hyper-regional specialities. Previous topics include medieval eels, 18th century dining, curry, London street food sellers, breakfast, and the good old Yorkshire pudding. Search for the British Food History Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to the delicious legacy. Cheers!
By the 17th century, the French too had adopted it. In La Varenne's Traité de Confitures, ambergris, almost always paired with musk, perfumes, diverse and candied fruit concoctions, and sugar paste pastilles, and pralines, and marzipans, and wines, and lemonade, and as well as a preparation called crème haute façon, which is basically crème anglaise. La Varenne also gives us these directions for preparing both musk and ambergris for use in recipes. To prepare your musk in proper way, put it in a little cast iron mortar, pound it with a pestle of the same material, mix it with a little powdered sugar, and after everything is well ground, put it in a paper so that you can make use of it as needed. You can prepare ambergris in the same way and even mix them together to use as much for beverages as for preserves. Early modern England. There's a curious lady of the 18th century who claimed to have read in obscure 16th century sources that ambergris was the au goût of Tudor court circles starting in the early 1500s. And by that we mean high taste, the thing to have. Perhaps this was true, but there's very little mention of it in the 16th century English printed cookbooks. Robert May, in The Accomplished Cook, 1660-1665, has some 20 recipes. Hannah Hooley, in Queen-like Closet, 1672, has close to 30. Hooley's fondness for the material is interesting, for she addressed the upper middle classes as much as she did the very wealthy. Perhaps ambergris was not quite as rare and expensive in 17th century England as we might suppose. Or perhaps it wasn't even ambergris, but something else. Both May and Woolley outline ambergris-infused medicinal drinks, and both have jellies, like gelatins, flavoured with the substance. But otherwise, the recipes differ. Woolley focuses on ambergris-scented marzipans, preserved fruit cocktails and sugar candies. May uses ambergris primarily in dishes involving eggs or cream or both. Eggs poached in syrups, scrambled or poached eggs on toast, which is a rare non-sweet preparation for the book, rich baked puddings, codling cream, snow cream, cheesecakes, and the mildly alcoholic hot custard beverage called posset. Manuscript cookbooks trend towards recipes similar to May's, their most common ambergris vehicles being rich, custardy baked puddings of bread and ground almonds, most of which feature dried or preserved fruits, and sometimes sliced apples or cooked artichoke bottoms too, lumps of beef marrow or butter, and plenty of thick cream and eggs. The following recipe is typical, except for the green potatoes whole, which we guess were the cream-colored sweet potatoes of the day, harvested when tiny and then candied and tinted green to resemble candied citron. And I'm going to put this recipe on my Patreon page for you to listen. So it's a recipe of almond puddings. It's a very interesting thing using this animal-like substance, flavor, odor, which it could be very subtle, of course, but still, use it to flavor things like sweet dishes and rich puddings and baked puddings. But it must have been fashionable and tasty and something people did, because also musk was used too, and musk is very animalic as well. And musk was not only used in most recipes calling for ambergris, but also in many recipes on its own, most famously perhaps in the musk sugar candies, or kissing confits, as Shakespeare called them, in reference to musk's supposed aphrodisiac properties that the Elizabethan English adopted from Italy and adored for sweet banquets. Whether used on its own or in tandem with ambergris and musk, they were generally deployed in English recipes with rose water and spices, a combination of all these different scents that could actually sound like a recipe for a perfume. So you have this animalic, musky, flora tones and undertones and so on. But in the end, tastes, I suppose, change. Things evolve, and cultures influence other cultures, and what is trendy and fashionable and so on. So in the end, the English predilection for animalic foods proved fleeting. Ambergris and musk appear in very few recipes written after 1700s. There's one cookbook by the author E. Smith, which has a recipe for whipped cream from 1727, which was supposedly copied by Hannah Glass in 1747 and in turn by Susanna Carter, 1772, and finally by Amelia Simmons, 1796, which is basically this recipe, this whipped cream recipe served with pastry in the second course of dinner or with cake at evening parties. So this cream is mixed with ambergris. The lumps, which are initially almost black in color, float on the sea surface, as we said. Of course, to float on the sea surface needs to rise slowly from the bottoms of the ocean where it originates, ascending slowly because it's slightly denser than seawater, through the frigid ocean and taken by the currents. Eventually, it reaches the surface where it floats and floats, forgotten and mostly submerged, sometimes for years. At sea, the ambergris floats. It bobs and rolls through cyclones and heat, from tropics, from stillness to doldrums, and then stalls in currents for months and months. It picks up speed in higher latitudes. It turns back again. It's trapped in ocean gyres and spends years and years navigating the Earth's oceans. This journey cannot be substituted. It seems and feels like wine in a bottle, and ambergris slowly matures like this at sea. Gradually reacts with its surroundings, oxidized by salt water, degraded by sunlight, and eroded by wave action. And then beached somewhere along a remote and windswept coastline, or dumped by a storm into a busy, populated stretch of water. By that time, it's an aged and well-travelled piece of ambergris. It's different, it has changed, it has been worked on by the ocean, and depending on how long it has been at the sea, its colour and texture will have evolved from black tar-like substance to a pale, smooth, waxy ball rolling in the surf. Over the years, it loses most of its water content. It becomes smaller, smaller, and denser, its exterior hardens, takes on a tough rind-like appearance. More than anything else now, resembles a light grey stone. A little like pumice stone, chalk or dried clay. Its surface might have a shiny patina on it. Its interior will be flecked with embedded squid beaks, just like burnt black seeds. It smells pungently and it undergoes another transformation. That fecal smell that characterizes freshly expelled ambergris gradually softens and is replaced by a rich and complex odor, described, as we've seen above, as sweet and woody and earthy and marine. So yeah, this is the mysterious ambergris, this weird substance that comes from the depth of the oceans, from the insides of whales, which accidentally rises and rises to the sea and reaches some random faraway corner of the earth, and some curious and weirdly attracted human takes this ball and wonders what it is. Very interesting thing, and very weird that we use it in perfumes and foods. It's just another mystery to me, really. And I found it fascinating, and I thought it might be an interest of you here as another exotic, weird and rare spice that we use in our historical foods. And of course, this trade on musk and ambergris, which expanded with the Arabs, with the Arab merchants, it brings me, however tenuously, to pomegranate. That might sound a bit weird, trying to include pomegranates, shoehorn them into a spice episode, a spice and this kind of flavoring episode, but it does make sense in a way. Obviously, pomegranate was very important in medieval Arab Spain, hence Granada, pomegranate, the apple from Granada, which became prevalent in northern Europe via the Arabs of Spain, the Moors. And although you might not consider the pulp and the seeds to be a true spice, as I said earlier, the seeds and the syrup of the pomegranate can be used and are used all the time as garnish and as salad dressing, in a salad dressing, of course, as flavoring for sauces. Nowadays, as it was back in the Arab times, it was considered also something that can be used as a medicine to promote well-being. And we've seen a lot of juices made from pomegranate these days to promote antioxidants and so on and so on. And we can say that there are a few different varieties of pomegranates, some very sweet and pleasant, others sour and bitter and astringent, or tartly and acidic. But they're all widely used, and they all have been used for millennia. The wild ancestors of today's domesticated pomegranates are likely to be of Central Asian origin. Also, some food historians pinpoint Persia as the place of first domestication, and others suggest a more broad arc between Caucasus Mountains in the west and Himalayas in the east. Curiously, another species of the same family tree is cultivated as an ornamental and is native to the island of Socotra, just south of Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, and between Djibouti, Eritrea, and the East African coast and Arabia. A very unique and very alien, in a sense, landscape, the Socotra Island. Anyway, I'm digressing with Socotra Island, but that's a fascinating place. Google it if you don't know about it. I love the ancient Greek myth about the pomegranate, about how Persephone was in the underworld, abducted by Hades. And of course, Demeter, her mother, she was mourning and the earth was barren. So Demeter was in Sicily, well, at least this is one of the myths and many variations of myths from ancient Greece that we get about the world. So they were never set in stone anyway, but one of the myths says that Demeter was in Sicily, one of her favorite places, supposedly, when Persephone, while playing with her companions in the Nicaean fields, she was carried off by Hades, the god of the underworld. Zeus, who was happy to play a trick on the faithless Demeter, was in plot with Hades, apparently. And hearing the girl's cries from far away, Demeter, who loved her daughter above all else, took the diadem off her bright hair and veiled herself in dark robes. Wailing with despair and flying bird-like over the water, which grew rough beneath her, and over the land, which turned to desert, she set off in search of Persephone. She wandered thus for 9 days, carrying 2 lighted torches, refusing to partake of nectar and ambrosia, or to bathe in any water but her own tears, until her beloved daughter should be restored to her. No rain fell from the heavy clouds that covered the earth, and no plants grew or ripened. Exhausted with wandering, despair and fasting, Demeter was taken in by poor people living almost on a level with animals on the outskirts of a forest. The Savlis and his wife Bobo and the 3 sons, half-wild herdsmen, they consoled her and at last made her smile and agreed to drink a decoction of barley and mint, which revived her. Thanks to these good people, the goddess gave them the ears of wheat she was holding before she retreated to the temple of Eleusis. The couple's youngest son, Triptolemus, determined to travel the world spreading the divine gift. Through him, men ceased to be savages, eating the plants they gathered and learned to cultivate grain. He is depicted driving a chariot with winged wheels and holding a sheaf of wheat as a whip. Since no one had anything to eat in Demeter's absence, no sacrifices or offerings were made to honor the gods. Iris, goddess of the rainbow, was sent to reason with the inconsolable mother, but in vain. One by one, the mortals came to lavish wonderful gifts upon her, but all Demeter wanted was her beloved daughter. At last, Zeus sent Hermes, messenger of the gods and patron of merchants, down to the underworld. And Hermes, who was noted for his cunning, persuaded Hades to release Persephone. The lord of the underworld allowed his mourning wife to go, but when she opened her mouth in a cry of joy, he seized his chance to make her swallow a pomegranate seed. She had now broken the fast and joyed upon all the underworld, and would have to return to begin it again. So this is the story of Persephone traveling between underworld and earth for 6 months per year, and that's hence why we have the winter and summer, and where the fruits ripen, and where there's joy when Persephone is back with her mother, and so on. In a more grounded historical context, pomegranate, obviously, it was native to Persia, modern-day Iran, and it was familiar in Egypt by the mid-second millennium BCE. So we're talking about 4,500 years ago. We can see and we find the unmistakable shape appearing frequently on wall paintings from then onwards all over the Mediterranean. And it was very well known in Greece, hence the myth with the pomegranate from earlier on. It is one of the fruit trees that characterizes the orchards of Alcinous in the Odyssey. And by then, the pomegranate was evidently spreading further west and west and west. It has been found by archaeobotanical finds in southern France, like 300-400 BCE. And the Latin name of the fruit, Malum Punicum, which we use for pomegranate, which means something like Phoenician apple, can be relied as evidence that the cultivation might have been introduced to Italy, or perhaps to Gaul or Sicily or whatever, by the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians. When pomegranate made it from Damascus to Al-Andalus with Banu Umayyah, it was a big hit. The first cultivar in Spain was named Safari, and it persisted with that name for hundreds of years after its introduction around 755 AD. But rather than retain the ancient Semitic term Al-Ruman for all pomegranates, the Moors and Syrians who immigrated to Spain instead chose the Latin-derived Pomum Granatum, which was Arabized and condensed to Granata, and then Hispanicized to Granada. And the latter, of course, as we said, became the name of one of the most important centers of culture and agriculture in Moorish Spain during the era of Convivencia, which is Granada. Sephardic and Moorish Jews became just as full of pomegranates as Arabs were, and used the image of the fruit above the doorways of their homes throughout the West. From Spain, pomegranate cuttings, including the safari variety, went on to the Canary Islands and then to the Americas. Athenaeus, writing about the classical Greek period, he mentions that the following seasonings are listed by Adiphanes: grape juice, salt, cooked wine, silphium, cheese, thyme, sesame, natron, cumin, pomegranate, honey, marjoram, fine herbs, vinegar, olives, green stuff for sauce, capers, eggs, salt, fish, cress, garlic juice. And there is a meat dish from Athenaeus who quotes a recipe from Epaminondas called, the dish is called mima, and a mima of any sacrificial animal or chicken is to be made by chopping the lean meat finely, mincing liver and offal with blood, and flavoring it with vinegar, melted cheese, silphium, cumin, thyme, Roman hyssop, coriander leaf, coriander seed, onion, fried onions or poppy seeds, raisins or honey, and the seeds of sour pomegranate. You may also use it as a relish. And now for the extra bit for Patreon backers only, on how the pomegranate reached Andalusia. If you remember in our medieval episode, the first ruler of Al-Andalus, Abd al-Rahman, he barely escaped with his life from Damascus when the Abbasids hunted and killed all his family. And that's it. This is the episode for today. Thank you for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You know what I'm going to say. Please, please, please go and review and rate the podcast wherever you're listening to your podcasts from. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Acasts, and share it with three friends. If you do me this favor, it means the podcast can grow and more people can listen to it and we can keep this going. Thank you for listening. I've been Thomas Dinas and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Have a lovely week. See you soon.